Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, please join me as I explore issues and ideas shaping our world with today's key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and right to the heart of the story. It's Thursday, the 12th of December. Coming up on the program today, the Road Freight Association calls for government intervention to reopen the port of Maputo. How government can restore its dilapidated buildings and infrastructure by using homegrown tech solutions. We'll find out what keeps South Africa's mid to top earners awake at night. And will substance overtake hype in 2025 company communication? The closure of Mozambique's Maputo port and the important Lebombo border post has significantly disrupted South Africa's trade logistics. This has led to a substantial economic loss, and reports are indicating these disruptions could cost the South African economy around 10 million rand a day. I suspect that is a conservative number. More now from Gavin Kelly, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Road Freight Association, who is expressing his increasing concern about the problem. Gavin, a very warm welcome. As we have this conversation today, can you give me a quick overview of the current situation? What's happening? What are you hearing?
Well, thanks very much, Jeremy. Once again, we seem to hear that the border is being closed. The Minister of Transport was there 2 days ago, and she said that the border was closed. We've got sort of sporadic reports about vehicles crossing the border. I think a fair amount of them are vehicles coming from Mozambique. We're trying to get South African freight operators out of the country, obviously for their own safety. At this stage, there are reports from many people in Mozambique that the opposition party or parties are going to step up their protests against the election results, which are about a month and a half ago, I think now, and are going to cause chaos at the port of Maputo and along some of the major routes, including the area around the port of Lebombo. So it's become very, very difficult to move vehicles, not only freight vehicles, passenger vehicles too, but in our case, to move our freight vehicles through that corridor to the port without any sort of of risk of being attacked by the locals or being held and then, you know, not being able to move.
So, Gavin, what are your members telling you today, and how are these freight companies then managing the challenges that you've just outlined to me? What are they doing?
Well, there's really two things that they're doing. The one is they've ceased their operations. They just cannot chance anything happening to their drivers. You know, a truck being burnt and lost, I suppose one can say, well, you can always claim that back from insurance if you've got that. But you don't want your drivers and your co-drivers that are going along with them, anything to happen to them. So they've ceased operations. Others are trying to get their vehicles back to depots because we have an added issue. It isn't only a problem in Mozambique in terms of risk. It is a problem in our own country. Now you have 22-kilometer queues of vehicles or vehicles standing around in local waylays, one could say, at a town here and a town there, and they're at risk of opportunistic crime. So they're trying to get their vehicles back. But there are some vehicles that are caught in queues. And, of course, the problem there for us is making sure those drivers have access to toilets, have food and water, because they would not have planned for this, and making sure their trucks are safe. So trying to work with local security companies to ensure when the driver's off looking after him or herself that the truck isn't ransacked.
I referenced economic impact, and I mentioned a figure of 10 million rand a day as a loss. I suspect, as I said, that's probably a conservative number. What's your assessment of that situation and how it's affecting the economy?
Well, there are really three parts to that, aren't there? The first is going to be the daily operational cost to an operator, and that's about 6 million of that 10 million rand when we last looked at it. And that was when we were having those absolute shutdowns of the border a couple of weeks ago. And yes, I think you're right. I think that is a conservative fee because we can only see what we are told. We can't see what we're not told. And then about the other 4,000 rand is all the supporting industry around those freight vehicles moving along that route and through that corridor. The bigger problem, Jeremy, is going to be that our customers outside of South Africa, the global customers, are slowly starting to get tired of this shenanigans happening in South Africa or from South African companies. We've had the ports issues, the rail issues. Now we have this in Mozambique. South Africa has really played its only pawn in terms of getting its goods out of South Africa by using the port of Maputo. Now that's become unstable. So what we are very worried about is that the global community is going to turn around and say, well, let me go source these things that I'm trying to get from you somewhere else. It, albeit a little bit more expensive perhaps, maybe a little bit longer, but at least that supply chain is guaranteed because I need those things for my production and for me to make revenue. So that's the biggest problem that we foresee down the line. Right now, there are companies who've said to us, if we can't get our trucks moving, if we can't get that revenue flowing, we've had it. We're going to close. We just cannot. We don't have the resources or the ability to absorb these sorts of costs of non-operation.
Gavin, effectively, South Africa shuts down on Friday for the festive break. Do you see any resolution before the end of the year?
Well, Jeremy, remember I said that the guys in Mozambique, the protesters, the group of citizens who are unhappy with the results are going to step up the protest actions from the weekend. And they've really said a number of things like closing routes and blockading ports. I don't see that happening, unfortunately. I haven't seen any movement in a higher echelon of government or from the SADC saying, well, let's sort this out. At least they could look after the route, guarantee that those sorts of operations that are required to move things into and through Mozambique are looked after, are protected. But no, I don't see a resolution before we close down.
And just a final one, you mentioned South Africa's Minister of Transport and involvement there. What's the South African government telling you today? And are you satisfied with any response that has been forthcoming?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is that this is something happening in the state next door to us. No matter how much we'd like Minister Creasy to go and crack the whip, it's not her domain to make such demands, is it? And from the South African Home Affairs, they've done the best they can, and they will close the gate with the Border Management Authority because they don't want to risk. So it's a very difficult one in this circumstance where the authorities have done, I would suppose, what was required for risk. I think on our side of the border, we would like to see a lot more involvement in terms of ensuring that the long queues are protected. The SAPS has done a sterling job at Lebombe, that I must say, at Komatipoort. But apart from that, no, not much. We haven't seen that pressure on the Mozambican authorities to resolve this as we would have liked to have seen.
Gavin Kelly is the Chief Executive Officer of the Road Freight Association. Gavin, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa manages something in the region of 93,000 government buildings and 74 hospitals. Yet, I don't need to tell you, many are in disrepair. Why? Well, due to neglect and mismanagement. And this often leads to huge frustration among citizens, and it also hampers service delivery. Locally developed world-class technology solutions could help restore this infrastructure efficiently while saving money. However, implementation challenges and systemic issues do raise important questions about the way forward. And in that respect, I'm in conversation now with Barney Khosana, who's the Chief Revenue Officer at Pragma Global. Barney, a very warm welcome. First of all, maybe just in your opinion, the current state of South Africa's government-owned infrastructure, what factors are causing the decline and how does it manifest?
Glad to be on your show. In answering your question, I think back to something that the new minister who came in after the recent elections was talking about when he went through, was probably doing his due diligence or assessment on his new department. And he said something interesting. He indicated that when they look at the asset register of the buildings that the Department of Public Works is meant to own, there's a lot of confusion in that register. They've found buildings that they're meant to, that they understand to be theirs and that they own, that actually aren't. And then they've then found that there are buildings which they actually do own that aren't on that register. And to me, that speaks to the source of the issue. if you don't know the assets that are under your control, and if you think of 93,000 buildings, I mean, that's a building for every single person in an FNB stadium. It's an enormous quantity of assets. And it's not knowing what you have, which then leads through to the fact that you can't then have a reliable register. And that register then, since it's the managing point of how you look after what you have, I think you can see the downstream consequences of not having a clear picture of what you own, what condition it's in, and therefore what interventions you need to make in order to keep those buildings in working order.
Let's talk a little bit about interventions in just a moment, but this neglect of state infrastructure must be costing the fiscus an enormous amount of money.
It costs an enormous amount of money, Jeremy, and beyond that, I recently spoke to somebody in the insurance industry, and when they show you the top causes of claims in the insurance industry, they all point to lack of maintenance. They talk about water damage, and they talk about fires, and poor maintenance in the form of, you know, electrical wiring that is not up to standard, etc. And so beyond the operational costs of looking after buildings, there is the massive issue of risks, of things going wrong, leading to claims if you're fortunate enough to have the insurance. And then beyond that, of course, is the simple health and safety of the people that work in those buildings. You hear of the sheer number of claims that the Department of Health pays for, you know, negligence that patients sue these hospitals for. It runs into billions. And a lot of the time I would put my money on the fact that many of those claims relate to poor maintenance of whether it be incubators where, you know, premature babies need to have certain levels of oxygen, etc. And since they malfunction and let's say sadly a patient passes away or gets brain damage, that results in massive liable suits that the government then subsequently has to pay. So you can see the link between good maintenance and, as I've said previously, a lot of downstream effects that we often don't think about and relate to maintenance.
Now, let's talk about that maintenance and particularly in terms of urgent intervention. And you would suggest leaning more towards technological solutions and smart building systems.
Definitely. We live in an age where a great deal has been obviously over the many centuries and more recently with the more sophisticated AI and machine learning tools, the capability to digitally to create what are called digital twins of things like buildings. You literally get a map of every nook and cranny of a building, where the equipment that's in that building is, and even the state of that building. You can do this, architects do it all the time, but there's sophisticated technology that even for existing buildings, you can scan those buildings, get a good digital picture of what state that building is, and then at very little cost, actually run models that tell you what the impact would be of repairing either certain pipes, electrical wiring, or the actual structure of the building. And then having gotten all of those models in place, you can then put them onto what we call an intelligent asset register, and then link plans for the maintenance of every part of that building to those various different pieces of equipment that sit in the building as well as the building itself. So you're correct. I would lean towards the what technology allows us to do and see that doesn't require the breaking down of walls only to find that perhaps you didn't need to replace certain pipes, etc. There's a lot of advantage that we get from the technologies we have available to us.
And you're painting a very encouraging picture, and you say at very little cost, but over 93,000 government buildings. Is that assertion entirely accurate?
Perhaps on an individual basis, I believe it is accurate. When I say very little cost, of course, I'm comparing it to the cost of either tearing down an entire building because it's reached such a point of decay that it actually needs to be ripped down. I'm talking about almost the predictive maintenance that you can do on a building. That's where the cost benefit comes. But you're right. The size of the issue, because of the deterioration that's been allowed to happen, there's no doubt that there's going to be a lot of upfront cost that is going to need to be expended in order to even begin addressing the issue. But as we go along, I'm suggesting that the cost will over time go down as buildings are repaired and then importantly maintained in working order. An example is just the Coburg Power Station. Over the weekend, I read that a 40-year-old nuclear power station is now being given a 20-year lease of life or extended life purely because of maintenance. And I think it's the repetition of that success story that we can replicate across many government buildings and infrastructure.
Thank you very much for joining me today. That's Bani Hosana, who's Chief Revenue Officer at the engineering company Pragma Global.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As we head into the festive season, middle-class consumers are facing a complex mix of challenges. Need I remind you, rising living costs, there's debt stress, there's a lot of economic uncertainty. We've just seen the inflation numbers tick up today, and all of that is weighing heavily, but not all gloom and doom, you'll be happy to hear me say. Recent data from BrandMap is providing a fresh lens on how we're all navigating these pressures, and I'm going to welcome back to this program Brandon de Kock, who's Director of Storytelling at BrandMap. Brandon, always good talking to you, and thank you so much indeed. So your data is challenging the widespread narrative that we're drowning in debt. What have you found?
Hi, Jeremy. Well, thanks for having me back. We generally tend to find that everybody tends to lump everything together. And I guess that's, for me, the main story that we're trying to tell. There's no doubt that there are a heck of a lot of consumers in real trouble. And when I say real trouble, they're just under massive amounts of stress. Whatever raises in income they're getting are certainly not meeting rising food and energy costs. But to lump 13 million people in what we call the middle market, so that's all the people living in tax-paying households, to lump them all together and go they're all drowning in debt is really missing a trick, I believe. So I think the story here, we're a very stratified society, and at least half of those people that we're talking about are really not feeling the pinch as badly as the rest of the market. So it's a little bit of a sort of a feel-good story for half of the middle market, if you know what I mean.
I suppose it depends on the definition of what feeling the pinch is. I mean, your pinch might be different to mine.
Absolutely. And I guess that's where the whole debt thing comes in. It's definitely a measure that we've put into play for the last couple of years. We've always asked the same question, which is simply, you know, how are you feeling about debt? And consistently, year on year, we find that there's less than about 30% of households that are actually debt stressed. So that means that the 30% of people really are debt stressed, but the others are either sophisticated enough consumers to understand how to use debt, how not to let it become an albatross around your neck. And then as you go even higher up the income bands, people start realizing, well, actually, you know, debt can be a tool. You know, it's not that they don't have any debts, it's that they're using debt to leverage a completely different type of lifestyle. So that's probably the main indicator, I'd say, is this whole idea of are people borrowing themselves into a lifestyle? And the answer is not really.
But if you are a so-called middle-aged adult, you are feeling things a little bit more starkly than perhaps younger people and older people such as myself.
Yeah, such as yourself and myself. I think when you look at the least debt-stressed people, are, as you say, the younger and older cohorts. And it makes total sense. It's almost like younger people getting into the market probably haven't had to embrace debt yet. And as they start having families and as you start needing to house your family and feed your family, the idea of needing to borrow money, whether it's personal loans from a bank or taking out, you know, using your credit card debt, that starts becoming much more of a factor for, let's call it, family generation people. And then what we find with the boomer generation is that they're the least likely to be in debt at all, probably because they've either paid their debt off completely or they're retired and have found a different way of living. So it really is about that. I'm not so sure about middle-aged. It's more about sort of middle-life people, you know, people who start families. It's a heck of a thing to deal with in the current economy.
Yeah, maybe those baby boomers just don't care anymore, Brandon.
Spending their money on other things,
yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah. It's interesting to see. You say that rising food and energy costs keep nearly half of South Africans awake at night. But there's a caveat, though. The inflation numbers are out. It has accelerated to 2.9% in November from 2.8% the previous month. But food prices, which are a key component of household spending, have eased further. And there's some nice drops in prices here. Eggs, for instance, down by 3.7%. 8 out of 11 food and non-alcoholic beverage categories, in fact, have recorded declines. So vegetables, cheese, bread, cereal. So there's a bit of Christmas cheer for us.
Yeah, just a little bit of cheer. The fact that we can all eat eggs more freely. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Here's what I think that story tells, is that we still live in a ridiculously volatile environment. We're just not sure what's going to get better or worse. I do think that if you take the whole year, so we've had one of the most stressful consumer years in, living memory virtually. We had water shortages in Johannesburg. We had Eskom issues. Then we had a very, very stressful election cycle. And I think that consumers were completely like deers in the headlights. You know, I don't think people knew what to do. But as we get to the end of the year, I don't know how you're feeling, but the idea of this, like the GNU seems to be doing something right. The inflation is still lower than it was. The consumer confidence indicators that keep getting published seem to be showing an upward streak. And maybe actually we're just starting to feel a little bit more confident about the future. Mm. I think we've come out of a year where people kept a lot of money in their pockets. You know, it wasn't a question not of having money. It was like, I'm just going to spend it and I'm going to be wise about it.
Brandon, thanks for including me in your example. But when you get to my age, you don't sleep well at night anyway because you've got to keep getting up. That's a different conversation entirely. What I do find interesting about your data, though, is spending patterns, you say, are shifting. And here's the nub. Discretionary spending is being postponed.
I think we still have a little bit of work to do to go and unpack that. But I'll give you an example of crazy trends. Do you ever keep track of the new passenger car sales? I can't remember if we've had this conversation.
We certainly on this program, we do that every month, yep.
Yeah, so, I mean, you would have seen the pattern, right? When I look at new passenger car sales, I think it's a great litmus test for consumer confidence and for what's going on. And if you look at the graph of new passenger car sales for 2024, it's absolutely crazy. It's like no year we've ever had. It's the first year I have in recorded history where April sales are lower than March. The bottom almost fell out of the market. And yet for the last 2 months, we've had the highest unit passenger car sales in 8 years. And you go, where does that come from? You know. So there are a few possible explanations. I do think that the two-pot system, maybe there were 5,000 or 6,000 people who felt like the most intelligent thing to do with their newfound retirement pot wealth was to go and buy a new car. Maybe it was some of the rates coming down. You know, the repo rate being low, it may have had a big effect. But if you just look at those new passenger car sales, it tells the story of an insane and crazy year. That's definitely, for me, a sign that those people had the money, because the new car purchase price hasn't dropped. You know what I mean? Things are still the way they were. I just think people have postponed their purchasing. And if you're a retailer going into the Christmas season, jeepers, I hope I'm right, you know, for Retail South Africa, because it's been a really bad year. And I think there might be a lot of pent-up retail therapy in need of satisfaction. You know?
Just a final one, and I'll keep an eye on the time because it's always against us. Tell me what this thing is called, the subscription generation.
Oh, so this, Jamie, I wish I had the actual data on it. This is a theory that we're busy trying to prove. And over the, we're hoping that there's sort of more interrogation, investigation. We're certainly going to be doing it going forward. There's a little hint in the data for me that there is starting to be an effect on consumer behavior in younger generations coming out of a world where we're so used to, younger consumers these days are so used to not purchasing big ticket items. You know, when you look at a motor vehicle and you go, sure, I've got to put the fuel in, I've got to pay the insurance, there's a lot of costs associated with it. Or should I just take an Uber rather? The subscription generation for me is very much Gen Z, a little bit of Gen X, and anybody younger. These are young consumers who are used to something like a subscription, right? So it's almost like rent suits the modern approach to life better than buying a house. And I do think that that may have quite a big effect going forward, that the traditional big ticket items may be sort of let go or backburnered in favor of more lifestyle. You know? Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And we're not going to talk again this year, but Brandon de Kock, Director Storytelling at Brand Map, I look forward to your next revelations next year. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
In today's world of misinformation and disinformation, and it comes at us like a steam train, the challenge of cutting through the noise to find authenticity, reality, I think is more pressing than ever. We've got artificial intelligence, influencers right across the spectrum, big data shaping how we're going to consume and share information. So what does the future hold for communications and brand trust next year? I can think of no better person to talk to about that than Patrick Gearing. He's Chief Executive Officer of Maropa Communications. It's one of the big reputation management consultancies in South Africa. Patrick, welcome. You talk about the irony of the information age being rife with misinformation. I guess it's only going to get worse, isn't it?
Absolutely, Jeremy. It's an incredibly exciting time for communicators and yet daunting for brands as we face this seeming deluge of information dump and you don't know what's real and what's not.
You talk about something called the trough of disillusionment when it comes to artificial intelligence. Again, within the communications space, Patrick, how do you see this shaping the way in which the communications industry is going to move next year?
Well, I think we face a bit of a dichotomy in how people are consuming content. So consumers are moving towards wanting authenticity, accountability, this emotional connection with brands, and yet we're turning to a robot to try and fix this in AI. And I think there's, as you describe it, this trough, because like anything new, there's this big hype about AI and what it might be able to achieve for us and throw in some fear that we're all going to lose our jobs because the robot's going to do it better than us. But that emotional connection, that sheer fact that people still want to hear stories from people, and that storytelling art is not going to go away. In fact, it's going to grow stronger and stronger for brands to get their message out there. And that is going to need a combination of embracing AI for what it can do in terms of quality, research, efficiency, all of those kinds of things, but not rely on it to actually create the content for us. So that nuance is going to have to be stuck with communicators to be able to actually craft into something that resonates with people.
And that's exactly my next question. So you've absolutely outlined the benefits of artificial intelligence within the space, but it is going to be hard to find that balance. So how do communicators need to approach that and develop a clear-headed way of doing it?
Yeah, it's about really understanding what AI can do and what its limitations are. So the big thing with AI is it has to learn from what is already out there. Now, in an environment where there's a lot of fake news out there, the robot can't necessarily distinguish between right and wrong. And so there's a potential that lots of what it serves up can be, in fact, blatantly incorrect. And so we've got to understand what's out in the Internet of Things, and then rein that into saying, well, what is actually truth and what is fake and what is on brand for a communicator trying to send a message out into the world to make a connection, so that we can then strike that balance of saying, well, what is actually still going to resonate with our ultimate customer?
Let's pivot from artificial intelligence to this notion of influencer marketing that is finding huge traction among brands.
The opposite of the robot.
Indeed. Do you think that audiences and brands are becoming skeptical of this particular strategy, or do you think that it does find some resonance? Again, give me a sense of what your clients are telling you in that respect.
Yeah, Jeremy, I think there's a balance between the two. So influencers we see as I think waning there in terms of the big mass market celebrity style of going out there, just because that really has been flooded. So the authenticity has gone away from it because people are realizing that influencers get paid to deliver a message. And that, you know, in good old traditional advertising parlance, that's saying, well, it's more credible if somebody just says they like something rather than being paid to say they like something. Not to say that influencers will disappear completely. I think they're going to just become a little bit more narrow focused in terms of, again, the authenticity of what they deliver. So does that person, celebrity or business influencer or whatever is in your specific market, but is there that air of authenticity that this is somebody who actually benefits from the message that they're delivering is saying is so fantastic? And I think that's an incredible opportunity if it's done correctly. But people certainly are seeing through the cloud of fakeness in just this, who's paying the next bill for me to get a message out to my million followers.
And done correctly, Patrick, is the key phrase there. And difficult for brands then to identify and collaborate with what I think you're referring to as smaller and more niche voices. You've just got to work a whole lot harder in finding those people and keep a rein on them.
That's right. It's the good old quality versus quantity. You know, we don't have to shoot the lights out in terms of metrics of reaching millions of people, because we might just be as successful as reaching 100 people who really, really count. And that, again, is building just brand value through that authentic content creation and engagement.
Patrick Gehring, I'm going to leave it there. Some useful advice for companies going into 2025. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Maropa Communications here in Johannesburg. And just before I bid you farewell, on our online poll today, either on X or LinkedIn, can homegrown technology fix South Africa's crumbling infrastructure? Either it's a cost-effective solution, deeper systemic issues need to be fixed first, or it depends on implementation capacity. As I say, if you have a view on that, you can participate either on X or LinkedIn. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.